To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest. The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Hello, Rory.
Hello, Rob. How have you been?
No real complaints. Just sort of rushing around the place, going on vacation for a bit, which I'm kind of excited about, and trying to get some work done before I do that.
Congratulations. Where are you planning on going?
I'm heading off to Puerto Rico, which is an absolutely delightful place to spend a week or so.
Will it just be chilling on the beach, or what's the big attraction in Puerto Rico?
Well, my hope, you know, I usually when I go down there, I have family down there, I go with a tote bag full of books and a project, and this time around I'm trying to put in more work on my next book, American Empire, the first 100 years, and of course Puerto Rico is a interesting and somewhat idiosyncratic aspect of U.S. empire, so it's a good environment to get down to some writing. And of course there's also a good deal of swimming and biking around and just not being in New York in February, which is kind of nice.
Sounds good. I will be laying an attic floor tomorrow.
Wow, well, that's exciting.
Well, I'll be helping my father. I just keep the segments of wood coming so he can just stay in the attic and lay it. So that's my Saturday.
That is a valuable skill. I'm a little nervous about my own floor, and I'm thinking that it sure would be nice if I knew how to do stuff like that.
But when you do stuff like that, it's important to fully understand agreements. Are there any agreements you've heard about recently that maybe two sides interpreted slightly differently?
That is an extraordinarily good segue there, Rory, because what I want to talk about today is the confusion, the unpleasantness, the disagreement, and the bad feelings between Turkey, Finland, and Sweden, specifically over the topic of NATO accession.
So basically, from my understanding, Finland and Sweden have kind of always wanted to join NATO, but were scared to upset Russia, so stayed in a kind of a neutral area until they've seen the horrors of Ukraine and thought the best way to prevent this from ever happening would be to fully join NATO.
I think that's definitely right. I'd, of course, put a little more nuance on it. I think the period of time when Finland and Sweden were outright scared of Russia certainly ended with the Cold War and probably ended a good deal before that. Both countries were aligned against the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but in the period of what looked like a lot of Soviet power in the aftermath of World War II, it's true they didn't want to antagonize Stalin or his successors by joining NATO. In the decades since, honestly, Rory, I'd say it's kind of a domestic thing. They just didn't necessarily see the need to join NATO. And I think there were significant, certainly probably not majority, but significant chunks of the population that preferred to, you know, preserve the veneer of being non-aligned. One of the interesting things about not being in NATO is that Finland and Sweden actually have much more serious militaries than a lot of our, you know, current NATO allies.
Well, yeah, if you speak to the majority of the Finnish male population, they have a very good understanding of artillery for that precise reason.
I wonder, does Finland still have conscription or universal? They do. Wow.
They do. any Finn I know is very has been in the army and has it. They're very very well trained for a conscription army. And it seems to be very modern, and I think they have the most artillery in Europe, I guess, until, you know, Ukraine really needed it.
So these are countries that are pretty good at defending themselves, and probably, like a lot of Europeans, spent the past couple decades, certain factions of their population, getting more and more skeptical of the United States. And for Finland and Sweden, two countries that were quite good at defending themselves, they didn't necessarily see the need for NATO. And then February, and then Vladimir Putin jumped in his inimitably idiotic way and convinced Finland and Sweden that it might not be such a bad idea to get on the winning team. And that is what they are very interested in doing by formally joining NATO. I think the point at which, I don't know that there was ever more than 50% support among these publics for joining NATO until after Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
It was definitely below 50%. I think sometimes even as low as, say, 30%. They were just happy with the way things were. But you also have to realize Finland did do a lot of trade with Russia. So it wasn't, you know, all hatred. They still just treated them as a skeptical neighbor, let's say. So there was, you know, and Sweden as well, there would be a lot of trade going both ways.
That makes a lot of sense. It's just you didn't necessarily want to antagonize this country. But
also there would be the idea, and I think a lot of the sort of pro-Russian supporters would say, Russia isn't that bad. You know, kind of like someone that has a gangstery air about them. You'd be like, they're not really that bad. People say this and they say that, nah, sure, NATO expansion. And then when it, you know, you're confronted with the reality, you go, yeah, hit the NATO button as many times as you can.
There's no question that Vladimir Putin has gone a long way towards making a bunch of folks who seemed kind of crazy very sane, and sort of vindicated a lot of national security types. Now, of course, I would argue that what Russia has been demonstrating over the past 8 months or so is just how incredibly hopeless and useless it would be if it attempted to invade Finland and Sweden. So I think you could also take the interpretation that the past year has made Finland and Sweden look vastly more secure, especially when you consider that they have had, because they're not, haven't been under the U.S.'s umbrella for the past 80 years, they actually have much more serious militaries. So I'm not sure it's the most urgent thing that they join NATO. I'm confident that they will be in NATO by the end of the year.
And I'm sure they're a lot more NATO compliant than the likes of Romania that seem to still fly very old MiGs.
No question. I think it's pretty clear that if Russia were to invade Finland or Sweden, it would at least be more than a couple months before Finland or Sweden had to come begging the way that Ukraine has to constantly for weapons outside their borders. And it's unlikely that whatever Russian contingent that made it into Finland or Sweden would last a couple of months. These are folks that are very much at the high end of military technology.
But also a military culture, and everyone, you know, the male population, I'm not too sure how the females are conscripted, but, you know, they know what's happening. They know where to go. Once they are invaded, you'll have the 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds know exactly where to go and how they can help the logistics. Like, that's all just ingrained into Finland and Sweden to a lesser extent.
So there's a lot of folks who claim that, I could probably have some quibbles with it, but we'd be here all day, that Finland and Sweden are going to just be awesome NATO allies. And a lot of folks are really excited by this prospect, which brings us to that stinker, the standard obstacle for NATO stuff.
Turkey. Oh, you've outdone me. Well done.
Evet. Turkey. En mutuşem ülke. So Turkey is standing in the way. Turkey is standing in the way. For those who are not aware, Turkey has now announced that henceforth they wish to be known as Turkey. And I will attempt to do that. I think that, as with a lot of things that come out with current President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's name on it, it's tempting for me to belittle that and just say, oh, F that, I'm doing Turkey anyway. But no, it's a legitimate national aspiration. Countries should be able to determine what they are called. So we're going to aim to do Turkey instead of Turkey. And I'm sure I'm going to screw that up.
But it also reminds me of Ukraine, which we used to always refer to as the Ukraine.
Yes.
And then Ukraine pointed out they'd prefer not to be called that. So now it's just normal to say Ukraine. Equally, we used to say, I don't know if they said it in America, it would be Kiev. So it's now Kiev. So we're slowly learning. But yes.
Exactly. If
countries change their name.
Well, did you see the film The Northmen? I
haven't yet. I've heard it's very good.
Oh, it's fun if you're into that sort of hyper-violent type of thing. I did enjoy it. But it is, what's funny about it is films, certainly films of that stature, are filmed usually like 2 years in advance or so. So in that film, they call Kiev. That is definitely, or Kiev or whatever it is. So that's definitely a transition we've all learned to make. So if you're super interested in being hypersensitive to calling Kiev or whatnot, and feel like mocking Turkey for asking to be referred to as Turkey, well, then there might be some assumptions you need to examine there. Not speaking to you, Rory, just people in general.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah. Turkey, the president of Turkey, it's going to take me a while to get used to this as well. Recep Tayyip...
Istanbul, not Constantinople?
It's definitely not Constantinople, no. Maybe They Might Be Giants will make another fun song about this. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, has decided to act as a spoiler. This is not new. I think Finland and Sweden started talking about joining NATO in March, and fairly quickly, Erdogan, made it clear... It's so frustrating. Made it clear that he was going to need some things. He was going to need some things from Finland and Sweden. And of course, the subtext here that isn't acknowledged as much because...
Kurds.
Well, that's acknowledged. That's not subtext, Rory. That's actually acknowledged very openly, very loudly, and very uncomfortably for everyone involved. No, the subtext here is that Turkey very much wants things from the United States, but does feel a little bit more restrained in the way that he can presume to order the United States about.
So Turkey would be geographically one of the most powerful members.
Oh, of course. I did an angry short about this a couple of days back. They are the most strategically important of the NATO members, arguably at any point, always, but certainly in the context of what NATO has been doing for the past 80 years, which is confronting the Soviet Union and confronting Russia. Because Turkey sits on the bottom of the Black Sea, Istanbul, not the capital city, but the largest and I would probably argue most important city in Turkey, is situated in both Europe and Asia on either side of the Bosphorus Strait, which is the only world access to the Black Sea, which is the sea that Russia and Ukraine share and are currently fighting over access to the Black Sea. So Turkey, especially in this moment, is incredibly important. So if you see particularly excited or excitable national security types being like, are we going to kick Turkey out to add Finland and Sweden? Are we going to kick them out of NATO? They're clearly not too geographically aware or too connected with reality generally. Or perhaps...
And Turkey's used to, you know, manipulating NATO, particularly America, because it is so geographically important.
Well, it's interesting, Rory, the way that the fight in Ukraine has really, really helped Erdogan. This Erdogan has been in charge of Turkey to one degree or another since, I believe, an election in 2004. It's a little confusing because he was barred from actually serving as prime minister because of a conviction, and then so he became prime minister a little bit later. But I think his party's been in power since 2004 or so. Could be wrong about that. And then he did the Putin jump from prime minister to president, or did Putin do the other jump? Anyway, so this guy's been in charge for a long, long time. And the conventional wisdom as of, January 2022, was that he was going to lose power in elections this year. He looked a lot like a dead man walking. And the United States, honestly, was kind of done with him. Erdogan was very important to Europe and the United States sort of in the mid-teens, around the time where everybody was really interested in taking out Assad in Syria, and then everybody was really interested in fixing the incredible problems of refugees that the Get Assad Project had created. So Turkey was a big part, Turkey was a big part of all of that, and Erdogan specifically was a big part of that. And that's sort of where he formed his current profile as this sort of bullying, lecturing strongman who everybody is honestly just done with. And Russia and Assad essentially won the war in Syria back in 2016, 2017 or so. And the refugee flows stopped being quite as dramatic. And everybody was just kind of done with Erdogan. Everybody was really sick of him and had no interest in catering to him in the slightest. That has certainly changed. And the reason that has changed is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Turkey has proved to be very useful to Ukraine, providing those drones. I believe a lot of the negotiations around keeping the flow of grain going are facilitated by Turkey. Turkey plays a huge role in the oil cap thing. We had an oil cap instituted by the G7 against Russia, oil price cap. Turkey's the country that's in charge of enforcing that. All of a sudden, Erdogan went from a guy who couldn't get his phone calls answered in Brussels or Berlin or Washington, D.C. anymore, to a guy who was getting personal visits from German chancellors and even a Greek prime minister at one point. The president of Israel went to Turkey to say hi. It's a real massive transformation. And he's been feeling his oats. You know, he's realized, how do you like me now? And he is interested in making demands.
And also, there's an election in June.
Well, the election, it was in June. It has been moved up until May.
Oh, that's handy.
Moved up to May.
Oh, it's sooner.
Yeah. So he's attempting to throw the opposition into disarray, which is usually pretty easy for the opposition in Turkey. There's probably never been a point at which you couldn't muster half of the Turkish population wanting to get rid of Erdogan or wanting to kick Erdogan out of power. The problem is that sections of this opposition hate each other much, much more than they hate Erdogan. So we'll see if the opposition manages to put together a agreed candidate. They seem to be in better shape than they have been recently. That does not yet mean that they are in good shape. And by moving the election up a month, Erdogan has taken away a month of time to negotiate and wrangle and position.
It's believed that these demands are generally being asked for, you know, because of the election. And once the election's over, they'll be allowed in.
I think what's going to happen, because I think that what Turkey is asking for from Finland and Sweden is completely non-negotiable. There's just no way that they're going to satisfy his demands, and we'll get into that. I think what's going to happen after the election is the United States is going to give him something, which is going to cause him to very quietly shut up about Finland and Sweden in NATO and, you know, quietly give his signature and move on. So I don't think it's going to be something that Finland or Sweden does. It's going to be the United States. I was looking into this afternoon and was having trouble finding the details, but I believe the United States still maintains sanctions against Turkey. To be clear, these aren't like Syria or Iran level country killing sanctions, but there are small sanctions against certain aspects of the Turkish military industrial complex related to their...
Was this for buying the missiles from Russia?
Exactly. They purchased the S-400 system. He had threatened to do this for years. The United States said, no, 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 don't do that. And then he went ahead and purchased it to the surprise of a lot of people, because NATO is about selling weapons. And the problem with the S-400 system, as distinct from the S-300 system, a lot of Turkish people like to point out that, what, Greece has the S-300. Why is it a problem that we have the S-400? Well, the S-300 was rolled out, I believe, at some point in a period before weapons were internet-enabled. The S-400 is got all kinds of hotsy-totsy networked detection stuff. So apparently if you turn an S-400 on within a couple hundred miles of an F-35, then to some degree it's believed that the F-35 secrets are given out. I don't know the details of this, but it does seem plausible to me that an S-400, a modern missile detection and defense system, would be a bad thing to have around.
Especially one made for export.
Yes.
You could make a very special Turkey special edition.
Well, there's that as well. It's true. It's that there's these things, these weapons have endless complexity. So it's entirely possible that Russia could have provided a version that is filled with more detection equipment that sends emails back to Moscow. I don't want to get too far into the technical aspects.
Oh yeah, but it's so it could just be so conspiracy theory. We just don't know. Plausible.
Well, it's very plausible. It honestly makes sense to me that the S-400 missile system would make it harder to sell modern weapons to that same country, which made it a really bad. This is something I emphasize a lot on the channel, which is that. I just don't know that Erdogan specifically, I'm sure many people in Turkey do understand, but I just don't know that Erdogan specifically understands how bad this is. Like, this is worse than ethnically cleansing all the Kurds in Syria from the perspective of Washington, D.C. I'm not saying it's morally worse. I'm not saying this is worse than setting himself up as a full-time dictator. NATO is about selling weapons. The U.S. government's highest priority is selling weapons. Turkey was a huge consumer, still is a huge consumer of U.S. weaponry. But the fact that they have made this purchase that makes it impossible for them to purchase the highest end U.S. weaponry is the worst possible thing that they could do from Washington, D.C.'s perspective. And this is why nobody was picking up his calls in Washington, D.C. anymore before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So the U.S. has all of these things that they can do, that they can give Turkey, I'm fairly confident that by the end of the year, we'll end up with Finland and Sweden in NATO. And as we were talking about just the prowess of the Finnish and Swedish militaries, you know, not to mention the fact that Russia's military has been pretty thoroughly beclowned, I don't think there's actually any physical urgency in getting Finland and Sweden into NATO. I think once we clear the Turkish elections, once Biden gives Erdogan some kind of gimme, I think they'll end up in NATO by the end of the year.
Has America and Britain not made a kind of little mini agreement with Finland and Sweden?
I'm not aware of it. Is there some kind of defense agreement?
I thought there was some, yeah, if you're invaded, we'll back you up sort of thing.
I'm not aware of that, but I think if you look at the profile of the weapons systems that Finland and Sweden use, I'm pretty sure Finland signed a deal to buy about $12 billion worth of F-35s. This is specifically one of the platforms that has been taken away from Turkey because they're now untrustworthy because of the S-400 purchase.
Yeah. So the F-35 is the most state-of-the-art fighter jet at the moment. That does seem to just be outstanding. And the price of them has significantly dropped. I know they were incredibly expensive, but they think, you know, in aviation, there's certain, like, regions of knowledge, I'll call it. So once you break through a region, it's like the next couple of generations will be much cheaper. So it's a bit like the first jet engine was incredibly complicated. Once you've made one, you could refine it. So yes, the F-35 seems to be a lot more reasonably priced and way advanced to anything else at the moment. I know the Chinese and the Russians say they have stuff, but they're keeping it under, you know, they don't seem to want to use it and have it accidentally disassembled in Texas.
Well, Ruri, I think you and I might have different impressions of the F-35, but I think that may be a podcast episode all of itself, and I'd have to do a little research on that. But regardless, the point is that Finland and Sweden, long before being in NATO, are already very heavily integrated into this sort of alliance system. I think sort of de facto are aligned against Russia and very powerful elements of alignment against Russia. I think what would be more interesting wouldn't be whether the United Kingdom or the United States would come to the defense of Finland and Sweden. I think what is probably already established to a degree is that Finland and Sweden would come to the defense of the Baltics if Russia were to invade Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania. I think that's a more interesting thing.
Well, Sweden has incredible submarine technology, didn't they? They had a system that they were doing war games with America, and it was so stealthy it was able to sneak up on the Americans. So America borrowed it for a couple of years to figure out its secrets. I think it's a Stirling engine, you call it? A heat-based motor that's very silent. So they have incredible technology.
I can't speak to that, but I'm sure that I am very confident that both Finland and Sweden are very competent and are not in any real danger from Russia at this moment.
Oh, definitely. Another thing about the embargo you were talking about, isn't that what brought about the Bayraktar drone that we all know and love today?
I think the Bayraktar was being developed significantly before the CATSA sanctions.
No, well, I heard, was it not they weren't allowed the Predator drone? So they were like, well, we'll make our own.
The thing is, Rory, a lot of these questions of whether what Turkey is or is not allowed are very complicated and fraught. If you ask the United States, and we'll get into that, I think, when we get to this tripartite agreement, if you ask the United States, they were always eager to sell Patriot missiles to Turkey. But the question is the terms, and the Turks believe that the United States was not willing to sell Patriot missiles to Turkey because what Turkey wanted was technology transfer, wanted the ability to participate in these productions chains, wanted the ability to sort of know more about and customize these weapons.
And a very common thing for a weapons agreement is, we'll buy your tanks, but we want a factory in our country. So I think Hechtler and Koch, for instance, you know, make guns, and it's a German gun manufacturer, and there's a huge, you know, factory in America, because they're like, well, we don't want to just give money to Germany. You know, we want in on that action. So having factories and shared knowledge, yeah, is a very common thing for arms agreements.
Oh, it's common in many, many industries. That's why it's the only way that Toyota can sell cars in the United States, is because of the number of factories that they have built built in the United States. That's sort of an established thing. But specifically around weapons technology, there's a higher level of trust you have to have there. It's one thing to say, oh, we'll sell you some Patriot missiles and we'll train you up on the systems. It's entirely another thing to say, oh, we'll let you into the workings and we'll start sort of trusting you to do this stuff. And Turkey was probably entirely within its rights to insist on those sorts of things, especially as a treaty partner of 70 years duration at this point. But the United States is just getting more and more stingy with that. So I don't know, maybe the United States did outright refuse to sell Predators to Turkey, but I'd be surprised if that were the case. I think it was more likely that they cut Turkey out of any potential for technology co-development or profiting and that sort of thing. And then that would be why they developed the Bayraktar. But I could be completely wrong about that. I'm just, you know, speaking out of my, speaking impromptu on that particular topic. So what I am somewhat prepared to talk about today is this tripartite agreement. Is that what they call it? Trilateral agreement between Turkey, Finland, and Sweden. That's an indication of how prepared I am to talk about this. So in March, Finland, Sweden decided, okay, we're going to join NATO. And Turkey said, not so fast. There was a lot of wrangling back and forth, a lot of demands. And finally, in Madrid, on the 28th of June of this year, there was this trilateral memo signed by their foreign ministers of all three countries covering how this process was going to proceed. Crucially, this was not saying, oh, we're going to let you join NATO. It was like, no, we're going to let you do the next steps in the process. It now seems like Finland and Sweden have very efficiently made it through the process, and now Turkey is blockading the next steps. So what Turkey wanted out of Finland and Sweden is pretty unrelated to Russia and Ukraine. It has to do with their longstanding issues, not just with Kurds, but also with other elements, the sort of broader FETÖ-affiliated elements that I think Turkey quite fairly believes are responsible for the 2016 coup attempt. It took place in July of 2016.
But also a newspaper owner of Today's Zaman?
Yes, I read about Today's Zaman. Let me say first that I think that many of Turkey's demands here are completely unfair. I don't think, even if these people are affiliated with, or rather, if these people are affiliated with FETÖ or affiliated with the PKK, that's the Kurdish terrorist organization, I think it should absolutely be left to Finland and Sweden's judiciaries to decide that. The editor-in-chief of today's Zaman is kind of the definition of a Gulenist. So I read recently about the today's Zaman guy. I think there was some kind of, was it a BBC article that sort of talked positively about him and, you know, gave him the opportunity to say, oh, gosh, I'm just a poor newspaper editor. How, it's so cruel of them to come after me. So today's Zaman was very famously a FETÖ newspaper. It was affiliated with the Gulenist faction that did attempt to organize a coup against Erdogan. That is not to say that it is appropriate for this newspaper editor to be extradited back to Turkey. That's up to Turkey to make the case in Finnish and Swedish courts. But that guy, yeah, the Today Zaman guy is definitely affiliated with the Gulenists.
So I'll go through the proposals here. So it's not to support certain groups. The groups are the YPG, the PYD, and the FETÖ Alliance. And then the second one is they want basically Sweden and Finland to sell them arms. I think Sweden stopped arms trades. So that has gone been agreed to. Because they're in NATO, they have to sell away. And then the third one is to hand over these individuals, which I guess the first and the third kind of blend together.
Well, so that's a really key thing here, is that if you look at the details of this contract, and I think I'm actually pretty well positioned to talk about this because my full-time job in Turkey for a couple of years was explaining English contract language to Turkish people. And I, just looking at this memo, you can see how Turkey's foreign minister could have gone back to Erdogan and said, yes, I got a commitment that you're going to, you know, they're going to extradite these people. But if you look at the language, it's really carefully, really carefully worded. So this is in number 8, I guess point 3. Finland and Sweden will address Turkey's pending deportation or extradition requests of terror suspects expeditiously and thoroughly, taking into account information, evidence, and intelligence provided by Turkey, and establish necessary bilateral legal frameworks to facilitate extradition and security cooperation with Turkey, in accordance with the European Convention on Extradition. I think the plain language of that can definitely be construed, and vitally can definitely be translated into Turkey to make it sound more like Finland and Sweden have committed to sending Turkey every accused terrorist they ask for. But from the perspective of legal English, that commits Finland and Sweden to absolutely nothing. You know, they will address Turkey's requests expeditiously and thoroughly. And if the Finnish and Swedish courts, you know, are expeditious and thorough about scheduling dates for these hearings, and then, you know, listen to everything that the Turkish government has to say about whether these people should go, then they have, and I think this is the Finnish and Swedish government's position and will be the Finnish and Swedish government's position going forward until everybody forgets about this controversy, is that they have done that. They have absolutely done that. And it looks like of the 12 people that Turkey wanted from Finland, they sent one back for a very straightforward criminal investigation, and have pretty much refused to send any of the folks for political reasons. And I expect that we don't have the time, and I haven't prepped going through all of the 130 cases. Though I do think it is interesting that one of the cases that the BBC selected the Today's Zaman guy as, you know, it being outrageous that, you know, the Turkey wanted to deport him.
Well, I think it's the one that the Swedish courts basically says we're not going to send him because it's purely political and it breaks our laws. So I think that's why they mentioned him specifically.
Okay. That makes more sense. But yeah, so it's political. And I think that the Swedish courts are entirely correct in coming to the conclusion that this guy would not get a fair trial in Turkey. And it is entirely political. And good on them. I was actually honestly pretty horrified when I saw in, I think, October, November, Finland did send an individual to Turkey. But looking into the details, I have not looked into those details recently, unfortunately. It seems like that was a very straightforward criminal complaint. It had very little to do with politics. Turkey's not going to get any of these politically linked people from Finland and Sweden. And to the extent that people in the Turkish foreign ministry were too scared to tell Erdogan that, well, it's an indication of problems with Turkey's political system. This is just straightforwardly was never going to fly. It's interesting because I think a lot of the news reporting is putting forward that Finland and Sweden have somehow turned Turkey down. Whereas if you look at the language of this memorandum, I'd say Finland and Sweden are in complete compliance.
Oh, yeah.
They are.
You could definitely argue they've done everything they've been told to.
They've done everything that is consistent with their system. And this trilateral agreement is very carefully worded so as to keep them from violating it. I think in Finland and Sweden, 70% of... Well, I don't know about Finland, but I think 70% of Swedish folks are fluent English speakers. That might slightly exaggerate it.
Yeah, there's definitely strong English in both countries.
And I'm damn certain they've got some top flight English speaking or English fluent contract attorneys. So this is a very, very carefully put together agreement. And it's just the idea that Turkey's going to get these Kurds or get these FETÖ folks is, I think, actually probably Erdogan knows he's not going to get any of these folks.
Could you tell us more about FETÖ?
Sure. So Gulenists, the Gulenism, man, I wonder, I probably shouldn't talk about it too much if I want people to listen to this in Turkey. But, I don't know. Turkey. çok özür dilerim arkadaşlarım. So, Fethullah Gülen is a cleric who has, of decades standing, been a Muslim cleric that the United States really loves. And especially after 9/11, he became even more beloved because it's kind of a Turkish thing, is he's a very Islamic figure, but also a very modern-facing figure. It's all about making a mix between Islamism and modernity. I think maybe to some extent you could describe this as sort of a Muslim Brotherhood adjacent thing, but it's always dangerous to try to apply Arab models to Turkish Islam. So this grouping, going back decades, built up a power base within Turkey. And what's interesting is that it would drastically overstate it to say he was responsible for Erdogan's rise, but without the Gulenist movement, it's hard to imagine Erdogan being as successful as he has been. So the Gulenists, probably by and large, would have been big AK Party supporters. And this network, crucially, is international, and it is a religious network. There are a lot of folks who have put a lot of money into it over decades. That money has gone out to fund education. They became tremendously powerful, not just within Turkey, but abroad as well. They were very intertwined with Turkey's large efforts in Africa. Turkey's efforts to build more of a connection to the Sunni world more broadly. The Gulenists were behind a lot of that, international schools, what have you, newspapers. So it was interesting. In Turkey, most of the people I hung out with were sort of Western-facing, liberal, modern types, and really, really disliked Gulen. And when I moved there in 2011, saw sort of Gulen and Erdogan as sort of the same thing. But what's interesting, after having established all of this power, Erdogan, about a decade in, the falling out definitely started earlier. Interestingly, a lot of one of the best things that I think Erdogan has done, still, one of the best things I believe Erdogan has done was defang the Turkish military. For all of the Turkish Republic's history, we've had a series of coups. It has not been a true functioning democracy because the military has been too powerful. And across the 2000s, the Gulenists, in alliance with Erdogan, went to war against the power of the Turkish military, which makes it incredibly ironic that it was actually the Gulenists and the Turkish military together that tried, the Gulenists, to, by 2016, controlled many aspects of the Turkish military, who together tried to get rid of Erdogan. So by the end of the aughts and coming to a very big head in 2012-2013, the Gulenists and Erdogan went to war. In, I believe, the end of 2013, the Gulenists released a wide array of audio tapes of alleged corruption with Erdogan. I remember at the time, a lot of people thought Erdogan's goose was cooked. That was going to be the end of Erdogan. Really, really strong conflict. And Erdogan hung on and started clearing the Gulenists out of the places that he had facilitated getting them into, the country's police forces, prosecutors, and the Turkish military. And in 2016, I believe Gulenist elements in the Turkish military, who were quite confident they were going to lose those seats pretty quickly, decided let's do it, let's be legends, and tried to get rid of Erdogan in a coup.
Was that a legitimate coup? Because I heard rumors that he kind of, Erdogan orchestrated it so he could use it to persecute his enemies.
That's certainly how he's used it. He has certainly used this coup to go after actual Gulenists who were part of the coup and really anybody who had continued dissenting against him. One of the saddest things is, you know, I had a lot of friends who were sort of liberal, you know, what have you, academics or what have you, who had always loathed Erdogan and loathed the Gulenists. But he used the aftermath of the coup to go after all of these academics who had, like, signed an open letter years before talking about aspects of Erdogan's rule that were bad. And it's just absolutely absurd that you would go after them as Gulenists. These are not religious people. But that's definitely the way that Erdogan has used it. I can see why that's become a sort of common rumor, but I don't believe that. I believe what's plausible, the worst interpretation for Erdogan, is that he got wind of this coup and had a sense that it was happening a couple days ahead and just let it happen. And then, because he knew he could take political advantage of it, that's got a ring of plausibility to me. That's possible. I'm not saying it's likely, I'm saying it's possible. But the idea, the full-on, like, oh no, this is all Erdogan top to bottom, he orchestrated this, that, I don't believe that. I simply don't believe that. It was a very real, because I lived there through much of this period. I left Turkey 2 weeks before the coup, actually.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah.
They just couldn't cope without you, Rob.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they really showed how much they missed me because the coup happened on my birthday. So, yeah. It's funny, I was back in Turkey in 2017 or 2018, and there were signs everywhere that said, remember Tammuz on Besh, remember July 15th. And I was like, everybody wants to remember my birthday. That's super sweet. Unut, what's it? Unutma? Or something, do not forget July 15th. I miss Turkey so much. It's a beautiful country.
Sorry, a side question. Would you feel safe moving back there?
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not that bad.
Yeah. No. Oh, gosh, no. It's so much safer than any American city. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there just aren't any guns there. Like, it's, when I left in 2016, there was, like, a rash of suicide bombings, but, like, I'd be vastly more likely to get hit by a car on any one of my bike rides in New York on any given day than I would have been to run into one of those, 5 to 10 suicide bombs that happened in 2016. So no, it's a very safe place. I don't think I have a profile that's anywhere near on the level that the Turkish government would have any interest in me. So yeah, no, I don't. I went back in 2022. Went back for a week and just sort of walked around Beyoğlu and loved it. It's a magical city, magical place.
No, no, it's definitely an incredible history in Turkey. And then there's the sort of, you know, how basically the Roman Empire still continued, but because it was a bit Muslim, it was sort of ignored with the Byzantines. I know that's a very long time ago, but it is just soaked in history.
Oh, it's very much soaked in history. And I think in a lot of ways, the Ottoman Empire was the successor empire to Rome.
Oh, well, it was Rome. It wasn't sort of a successor.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Rome was in these different regions, and one region collapsed and one stayed going. So it seems unfair to sort of say, oh, well, just because it doesn't sort of suit our, you know, notions of Europeanness that seems to be entrenched with the Roman Empire, just to sort of poo-poo it.
Well, there's a long history of that, actually. I mean, the whole reason we call the Byzantine Empire the Byzantine Empire is because Edward Gibbon didn't feel like the sort of Greek successors to the Roman Empire were Roman enough. The Byzantine Empire knew themselves as the Roman Empire. And we called them the Byzantine because some Victorian historians didn't think they were...
Makes it sound foreign.
Yeah, they were enough like us. But just one point on the whether or not the coup was real. Just living in Turkey from 2011 to 2016... and following the news pretty closely, this was a real battle. The battle between Erdogan and the Gulenists and between Erdogan and absolutely everybody else was a very, very real fight. And it is very plausible to me that the standard story of the coup is accurate, that this was a band of Gulenists in the military who thought they
would... It was a threat at some degree.
Yes, it was a real threat. Probably a desperate threat that these guys should have known better. But I think it was a real threat to Turkey. So that's what FETÖ is, and that is what Turkey... So Turkey, it's two things. Turkey has a legitimate grievance against FETÖ folks, and if they can prove it, there's probably a reason to extradite certain Gulenists to Turkey. If Erdogan wasn't Erdogan, there probably never would have been a coup. But if Erdogan wasn't Erdogan, I think the Fethullah Gulen, the leader of the movement, lives in Pennsylvania and has lived there for decades. And I think that if the head of Turkey wasn't Erdogan, I think there'd probably be a lot more interest in extraditing him from the United States. At this point, he's so...
I did think that was funny, all these like temper tantrums over Sweden. And it's like, the guy we dislike the most lives in America, but we're just not going to say anything.
Oh, I'm sure they've tried. But the thing is, you can't talk to the United States the way that you can talk to Sweden and Finland. And I think that's a really great irony here. And another irony that folks just keep throwing in my face in the comments, which I found kind of irritating, but I think is actually pretty on point, is that, you know, Sweden kind of has a history of facilitating extradition stuff for bigger players, like the United States' interest in Julian Assange. Which I had forgotten. I had forgotten about the Swedish role there. But what's key about that, and this is another part of just sort of Erdogan's tone deafness, or maybe this is very conscious and he's just doing this for political reasons, it's not like Obama was like, hey, Sweden, give us Assange. It was like, it was very back channel and very carefully done. And, you know, if there was, and I'm not saying there absolutely was, but it's plausible, there could have been, if there was U.S. intelligence community pressure on Sweden, it was they've picked the right judge to subtly influence, or they picked the right person at the justice ministry or the whatever it is that Sweden has. They carefully, quietly figured out a way to screw Julian Assange. It was not Obama being like, hey, give us all the WikiLeaks people, put them on a plane right now. It's just not how these things work with civilized countries. I know it's very inflammatory to sort of say something like Erdogan's being uncivilized, but it's just that it's just in this aspect, he's probably consciously playing the part of the strongman thug, angrily shouting for something he knows he's never going to get.
For politics at home.
Yes, for the purpose of politics at home. I do have to say, this trilateral memorandum, though, I think Finland and Sweden kind of, it's carefully worded. It's carefully worded. They would never, they've given themselves all kinds of outs while pretending that they were actually giving Turkey something. But there are aspects of this that honestly are a little abject on Finland and Sweden's part. Just talking about how, oh, we've recently done more terrorism legislation. Sweden confirms that a new tougher Terrorist Defenses Act enters into force on July 1st. I tried for a solid 10, 15 minutes and could not find any information as to whether or not this new Terrorist Defenses Act came into force. But if it did, it's pretty gross, honestly. The idea that Finland and Sweden are taking steps to better tailor their legal system to Turkey's requirements. I'm sure that's not...
It's possible this... It seems like it was happening anyway, and then they were able to sell it as if they were pleasing Turkey.
That certainly is what it looks like for the Finland thing, which is talking about amendments that came into force on January 1st, 2022. That's before Finland even knew it wanted to join NATO. But it does... It looks a little icky to me, and maybe that's conscious. Maybe that's putting in this, you know, Sweden confirms that a new, tougher Terrorist Defenses Act enters into force on July 1st, and that the government is preparing further tightening of counterterrorism legislation. So yeah, that's probably just a way to better sell Turkey on this agreement and better create the illusion that they're actually going to change something. But I think it's honestly kind of gross and kind of below Sweden and Finland to promise stuff like this, even if they know they weren't actually promising stuff like this. It's kind of a gross document, despite the fact that it's clear that Finland or Sweden didn't actually mean to commit to what Turkey thought they were committing to in this trilateral memo. It does leave sort of a bad taste in my mouth. It's like Finland and Sweden shouldn't even be willing to pretend to promise to discard judicial independence on these issues for something as trivial as a NATO membership they don't really need. So that left a bit of a bad taste in my mouth. But if Erdogan thinks he's going to get more of these Kurds and Feto types, he's dreaming.
So you are certain that Sweden and Finland will join NATO?
Well, I can't be certain about anything, Rory. It's, you know, I'm still that much of an attorney. I refuse to give anything too definitive. But I would say that if Finland and Sweden still want to be in NATO by the end of this year, I don't see there being any serious obstacles from Turkey. I think that Erdogan's going to want to win this election. If he does win the election, Biden will give him something, and he'll just sort of quietly sign the paperwork, or Çavuşoğlu will sign the paperwork, the foreign minister, what have you.
All the S-400s he could handle?
I think, Rory, like, the S-400 issue is probably more important to the... It's certainly more important to the United States than speedy victory in Ukraine. It's because the U.S. wants to keep selling weapons, and I think it's... The S-400 issue is not going to go away, but I could definitely see... There's so much that the United States can give Turkey that it shouldn't be a problem. And I really, 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 what I am very confident of is that Turkey's not going to get anybody beyond what the Finnish and Swedish judicial systems decide Turkey should get. That I'm much more confident about.
So the low-hanging fruit they'll get, but nobody that really shouldn't leave.
Exactly. They'll get actual criminals. They will not get political criminals. And there could be some where the line is a little shaky, and that would be unfortunate. But the idea that they're going to get all 130-odd people that they're asking for put on a plane is fantasy. With that, I guess we're mostly done. And I wanted to point out that if all goes well, I'm actually going to be uploading a produced half-hour-long video, magnum opus, on U.S. policy in Africa, which is going to be one of the angrier videos I've ever made.
Oh my goodness. I thought you loved AfricaCom.
Yeah, AfricaCom. AfricaCom is my, you know, love those guys. Do lots of useful things. You can find out what I think of AfricaCom and its record at great length, hopefully on Tuesday. So that should be coming out the day after the upload of this podcast. So that's very exciting. I've been behind on produced videos, and it's nice to get it. This is maybe the longest produced video I've done, or maybe it's shorter by a minute or two. I think I did a very long Ethiopia video about a year ago, but this is, it's a doorstep, and I'm excited to get it out to folks. So y'all should go to the YouTube channel and check that out.
It does sound incredible. I definitely will have to myself.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm touched, Rory. I'm touched that you deigned to watch my videos. You'd think you'd have enough of hearing Rob lecture every week, but I'm touched that you
can't have enough. If you'd like to help Rob out, if you could go to iTunes and give us a wee review and 5 stars. I think the other stars don't work, so you can only give 5 stars, I'm afraid.
Yeah, sadly, that's all you can do.
That would help us out greatly.
I'd be very grateful.
So thank you very much for listening. And let's hope you all have a wonderful time in between episodes.
Indeed.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better, and music provided by Kevin MacLeod.